Devaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, introduction, in page number 6. So Mahatma Prabhu read one paragraph yesterday, but I shall repeat it, just because it's a nice paragraph. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita should be taken up in the spirit of devotion. Top of page 6. Unless you've got the old version. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita should be taken up in the spirit of devotion. One should not think that he is equal to Krishna, nor should he think that Krishna is an ordinary personality, or even a very great personality. Lord Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. So, according to the statements of Bhagavad Gita, or the statements of Arjuna, the person who is trying to understand Bhagavad Gita, we should at least theoretically accept Sri Krishna as the supreme personality of Godhead. And with that submissive spirit, we can understand the Bhagavad Gita. Unless one reads the Bhagavad Gita in a submissive spirit, it is very difficult to understand Bhagavad Gita because it is a great mystery. Just what is Bhagavad Gita? The purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to deliver mankind from the nescience of material existence. Every man is in difficulty in so many ways, as Arjuna also was in difficulty in having to fight the battle of Kurukshetra. Arjuna surrendered under Sri Krishna, and consequently this Bhagavad Gita was spoken. Not only Arjuna, but every one of us is full of anxieties because of this material existence. Our very existence is in the atmosphere of non-existence. Actually, we are not meant to be threatened by non-existence. Our existence is eternal, but somehow or other we are put into asat. Asat refers to that which does not exist. Out of so many human beings who are suffering, there are a few who are actually inquiring about their position as to what they are, why they are put into this awkward position, and so on. Unless one is awakened to this position of questioning his suffering, unless he realizes that he doesn't want suffering, but rather wants to make a solution to all suffering, then one is not to be considered a perfect human being. Humanity begins when this sort of inquiry is awakened in one's mind. In the Brahma Sutra, this inquiry is called Brahma Jigyasa, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Every activity of the human being is to be considered a failure unless he inquires about the nature of the Absolute. Therefore, those who begin to question why they are suffering, or where they came from, and where they shall go after death, are proper students for understanding Bhagavad Gita. The sincere students should also have a firm respect for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such a student was Arjuna. Lord Krishna descends specifically to re-establish the real purpose of life when man forgets that purpose. Even then, out of many, many human beings who awaken, there may be one who actually enters the spirit of understanding his position. For him, this Bhagavad Gita is spoken. Actually, we are all swallowed by the tigress of nescience. But the Lord is very merciful upon living entities, especially human beings. To this end, he spoke Bhagavad Gita, making his friend Arjuna the student. Being an associate of Lord Krishna, Arjuna was above all ignorance, but Arjuna was put into ignorance on the battlefield of Kurukshetra just to question Lord Krishna about the problems of life, so that the Lord could explain them for the benefit of future generations of human beings and chalk out the plan of life. Then man could act accordingly and perfect the mission of human life. Om Gyana Tumirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandayaham Sri Guruho Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Navaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrijatam Sagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakan Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyaeva cha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Prajarine Nirishesa Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarini Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gurudhara Sivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So it's very nice this year. We're taking some time to look at this introduction instead of trying to rush through it. This introduction is so important that Prabhupada distributed it as a separate book. And it's a very complete summary of the philosophy. So this section we're doing today is called The Purpose of Bhagavad Gita. The purpose of Bhagavad Gita is to deliver mankind from the nescience of material existence. So towards the end of this section, Prabhupada mentions that of very few people actually try to question the purpose of life. He's saying that they don't even try to put an end to suffering. And then as even of the many who try to awaken and find the purpose of the lost of life, so many of them get lost. So this was in some ways the subject of what Mahatma Prabhu was talking about yesterday. He was talking about so many reasons we might choose not to try and find out who God is, because we just simply have a desire to find out that God is not. So even asking why we are suffering doesn't actually guarantee we're going to find the answer. And Krishna says later on in the 9th chapter, out of many, many people who are searching for the absolute truth, hardly one will know him in truth. So the special position of the Bhagavad Gita is here. And also Mahatma Prabhu was talking about how people have misused the Bhagavad Gita in order to sell themselves. They have decided to put some interpretation on it, to give people a reason to buy their Bhagavad Gita version and not somebody else's. So they haven't presented Bhagavad Gita as it is, even though it's so clear that Krishna says that I am that Supreme Person. So this position of suffering, Prabhupada is explaining how everybody is suffering, but not everybody realizes their suffering. But there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam where Lord Brahma describes the condition of the human form of life. He's talking about the different forms of living entities. And he says this 9th form is the human form. And one feature about them is that their stomach is hanging, so therefore they will never be satisfied. And the other feature that he explains is that they count their happiness on the basis of how many miseries they have. So if you have less miseries than someone else, you say you're happy. If you have less miseries than you had the day before, you say, oh, now I'm happy today. But still the miseries are always there. Now, Mahaprabhu also nicely explained how for our so-called material happiness, we have to put in so much work beforehand to get to this point, this so-called happiness, and then we've got a reaction afterwards. He was talking about work, how we work so many months of the year to get a couple of weeks' holiday. I was always struck with total, I couldn't understand why would one would have to work 5 days in order to get 2 days off. And then a lot of people working 6 days and only getting 1 day off. And so you work so hard for 6 days just to get 1 day off, and then that 1 day off you have to clean the house. You can't just enjoy all day. You have to clean the house, and you still have so much to do. And then maybe your enjoyment is to go out and get drunk, and then there's a reaction for that. You get a hangover, you feel sick the next day. You lose all your money, you have to go out to work the next week and work some more. So these miseries are there for everybody. But most people just accept them. It's like in the field of like counseling and psychology, their idea of success, if somebody is peaceful working in this material life. In other words, if you don't accept this material life of working 5 days or 6 days and getting 1 or 2 days off, then you're unbalanced and you need some treatment. And the perfection of their treatment is if you go back to working 5 or 6 days and getting 1 or 2 days off and don't complain to anybody else. You know, and you fit in with society and just do what everyone else does, and that's a success. Then your treatment is complete and nothing more is required. So for that reason, I was always a bit scared of that, especially that drugs that have come out are especially meant also for that. If you have some disturbances, like in modern society, I think the figures are outstanding, that like something like a third of the people or more in America today are going to suffer from mental imbalance, and some figures even say more. Suffer from depression, suffer from some problems. And then what is the purpose of the medication they'll give you? It's simply to make you feel happy in a miserable condition. The sole purpose is to make you feel peaceful, to not make you feel unhappy, to not make you feel as if you don't know what's happening. And so this is the purpose of modern civilization, is simply to make you feel happy in a miserable, suffering condition. So, Srila Prabhupada speaks more of that in chapter 2, verse 7, which is the verse where Arjuna surrenders to Krishna. So here in today's part, Prabhupada had said, Arjuna was also in difficulty having to fight the battle of Kurukshetra. Arjuna surrendered unto Sri Krishna, and consequently this Bhagavad Gita was spoken. So this is an important point, how this inquiry begins with the submissive spirit. So chapter 2, verse 7, Karpanya dosho pahata svabhava prichami tvam dharma samudha cheta yatcheya Shanishtitambruhitanme Sishyastehamsari Mam Tvam Parpanam. So this is a very famous voice. It's the verse where Arjuna surrenders. He says, now I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. So it's very significant in this verse that up until this point, Arjuna and Krishna were friends, and their relationship was friendly. They would joke together. They would sometimes discuss things together. Arjuna would consult Krishna. Krishna would consult Arjuna. But it wasn't at that of a teacher and a student. So this process of inquiry begins when we have the submissive spirit and actually surrender and seek to learn. Because otherwise we will not learn. Now sometimes we get so enthusiastic coming to devotional service that we miss this point. I know I missed this point when I first came, because there was so much to learn, but the actual choosing the spiritual master and learning how to surrender to him is something for me that took some time to learn. Because we have to learn. We have to find that person. In ISKCON there are so many qualified spiritual masters, but we have to find that spiritual master whom we can surrender to. We have to be able to develop that faith in that person, that this person I can surrender to. So many people can give us the great knowledge, but we have to have that relationship. We can have that submissive spirit and actually learn from it. So this verse, Tadvidi Pranipatena, in the fourth chapter, is also very important, because it tells us the medium of that surrender, that we surrender by submissive inquiry and by offering service. So the knowledge will only come with this combination of submissive inquiry and service. We have to have the service attitude, otherwise it won't come. There's some nice examples of how this service attitude helps us to gain transcendental knowledge. Of course, it's not something we can understand with our mind, with our intelligence. But there are some nice stories about how it happens. There is one, I think, quite a important person, quite a great person, came to Bhaktisiddhanta and wanted to ask some questions. Bhaktisiddhanta said, "No, I'm busy just now. You just go and find the pot washer and ask him." And he went out to the pot washer, and the pot washer says, "Oh, I'm just busy right now. Can you just help me for a while?" And then, so he helped him clean the pots. And then after some time, he was ready to go. And they asked, "Well, what about your questions?" And he said, "No, I don't need to ask the questions anymore. Now I have the answer." There's also a nice story that Keshi Damana tells about his brother. He says that his brother came to the temple, and Keshi Damana had been preaching to him for quite some time, but his brother couldn't understand anything. But he came to the temple, he went to the temple programs, he got up for Mangal Arati and attended Mangal Arati and chanted japa with his brother. And then he said in the morning, he said, "Oh, now I can understand what you were telling me." Because that process of engaging in service and that process of surrendering to chanting the holy name is what we need. Mahatma Prabhu also said the same thing. He was talking about how the mercy comes from Krishna, but we have to endeavor for it. We have to put some endeavor in order to get the mercy. So this verse that I was just reading, 2:7, the purport is explaining exactly the same. This first bit of the purport is explaining the same as today's. By nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexities for everybody. In every step there is perplexity, and therefore it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All the Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexity of life, which happen without our desire. They are like a forest fire that somehow blazes without being set by anyone. Similarly, the world situation is such that perplexities of life automatically appear without our wanting such confusion. No one wants fire, yet it takes place, and we become perplexed. The Vedic wisdom therefore advises that in order to solve the perplexities of life and to understand the science of the solution, one must approach a spiritual master who is in the disciplic succession. A person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. One should not therefore remain in material perplexities, but should approach a spiritual master. This is the purport of this verse. So Mahatma was talking about how so many people don't search in the right places. They don't ask the right questions. Instead of asking who God is, they ask why there is no God. They try and prove that there is no God. So therefore they will not find the right answers and they will not find the right spiritual master. Prabhupada always called this material world a place for the cheaters and the cheated. If we want a simple solution, if we want an easy solution and quick happiness, then we will find somebody who will cheat us and promise to give it to us. We will find a cheating spiritual master who will produce a little smoke or a few ashes, and we can accept him as God and think we're going to be having a wonderful life, but actually nothing changes. We give him some money, he may give us something like a mantra or just a piece of ash, and we think we've got something, but we've been cheated. Because we're looking for a quick fix, we're looking for a quick solution, and we won't find it. We'll simply be cheated. But if we're sincere, then the mercy comes. So if we're sincerely seeking the solution to the perplexities of life, if we sincerely look and see that these miseries are everywhere, and we look for a solution, then Krishna will help us find this bona fide spiritual master. So mercy is... mercy is nice. Srila Prabhupada has designed this whole system of Krishna consciousness in order to spread this mercy everywhere. He's designed like when people come into the temple, they might just come in by chance. They might come in because they're visiting all the temples in the area. But if they come in, they will be engaged in some kind of service and they will get some kind of sukriti from it. Like from the very beginning of the day, we begin by the worship of the spiritual master. So someone who comes by chance into the temple participates in the morning arati, which is not just honoring the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which it is, but by itself may not clear our doubts. But it's also glorifying this pure devotee. So in this way, somebody who participates with unknowingly will gain some sukriti, and gradually the sukriti will build up. And similarly, after the arati, we have the tulsi prayers, which is again the worship of the pure devotee. So somebody who attends that, and the tulsi, especially in India, the tulsi is held in very high regard. But if they attend that and do some worship, they will gain some sukriti. And gradually this will build up, and then they will gain the mercy to seek the association of the devotees. That is how the mercy manifests itself. The mercy manifests when we become interested in associating with the devotees. Rupa Goswami says, Ado Shraddha Tata Sadhu Sangha. So this mercy gives us a little bit of faith, and that little bit of faith makes us seek the association of the devotees and then take shelter, and from then on we engage in service, Tato Bhajana Kriya. So we engage in some activities. And then this bhajana kriya, this engaging in service, will help to purify us and bring us on to the higher stages of nishta and asakti, ruchi, and bhava and prem. So like that, mercy is available for those who by some chance get a little bit of sukriti to begin. But so many people are not interested. So many people are just stuck in material life. And so many people have their own agenda to try and prove there's no God, to try and prove that they are God, to try and maintain control for themselves instead of giving up control to others. And in this way, the Vedic literatures are also trying to gradually bring people at lower stage of consciousness towards that by promoting things like worship of the demigods. The Vedas promote belief in someone higher than ourselves. If we think we're God, then we don't surrender to anybody. But if we think that demigods can give us what we want, we at least surrender we at least acknowledge that they're higher than us. So that's the next stage. And then coming on beyond that, you start to come into Brahman realization and Paramatma realization and ultimately Bhagavan realization. So for one who is not following the correct path, if they at least start on the Vedic path, then they will make some progress. But until we get the Sukriti to come to devotional service, that progress will be very slow. Now, let's see what we're missing here. Tato Bringa, yeah, we've been speaking about that. Okay. Does anyone have some comments or questions or discussion? Yes.
So what do we say to people when they just say they don't even believe in God? Whatever. How can I convince them? So I just usually let it go. I have a friend that's just so into science and things. And I have so much I can say, but I say, how can I convince her? So I just don't say anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fact. Actually, our ninth offense of chanting of the holy name is to instruct a faithless person. Nevertheless, we try and preach. But if we find somebody who's totally inimical, then yeah, we have to let it go.
You're saying it's an offense to try to convert them?
No, but if it's not an offense to preach to people and try and share the knowledge. But if you find that they're just becoming angry, then it's best to let it go. Because then they will become offensive. So then it makes it worse for them, because then they're offensive to Krishna. If you're trying to explain about Krishna and they become angry, then they can become offensive to Krishna. So generally, sometimes Prabhupada would argue with people, but he had some potency. But still, there were some people who would argue with him, and they would come every day and argue with him, and he would argue back. But it was like a leela. They liked to come and argue. They enjoyed that argument. But generally, Prabhupada would advise that in such a situation, you just work on the secret weapons, which is you give them some prasadam. There are some amazing stories about the power of prasadam. Like I've heard some devotees here in this class talk about book distribution in America in the early days, and they would go into the airports, and the airport authorities and security would chase them and arrest them and harass them and everything like this. And but one time this security officer took some prasadam, and many years later he stopped them on the road and he says, "Yeah, I was one of these security officers who harassed you. But now I want to know what it is you're trying to distribute." So like that, we don't understand how it works. But if we can give mercy in the form of prasadam, then that will help.
It's interesting you say that, because one night she said to me, "Do you remember, I studied the Sikh path for 10 years also."
Yeah.
She said, "Do you remember that spiritual name that your guru gave me?" And I said, "Oh, I don't remember the name." She said, "Let me go and get it." And she went to the house and she took it out of her drawer and came out and she wrote it down. "Yes, my name is I forgot what line means in Hindi, but something like that." And I was like, "Oh, wow." I was so surprised that she even remembered that.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's a little touch to show that she doesn't necessarily think maybe, but she does think that she's in charge of herself and no one else is. But I thought it was so sweet that she kept that name.
Yeah.
In a way, you know?
Yeah, just some little mercy like that. Some words, a name. I mean, there is an organization set up by Prabhupada. What's it called? That challenges the scientists. I mean, science can be challenged because it is just a hypothesis. When I was at university, I was trying to enter into architecture. So you had to take an arts paper, you had to take a science paper, and you had to take some other paper. So I didn't know anything about arts. So I chose philosophy. But one thing I chose, the two philosophy papers I took were interesting. One was logic, and the other was metaphysics. So when you study metaphysics, it basically you're studying the philosophy behind physics. And you're learning that everything is a theory. Completely everything they believe is fact is actually a theory. So if you really want to discuss on that level, you can challenge the hypothesis behind the theory. And even the fact that so-called facts are proven wrong. After a few years, somebody else comes with a new theory. Like, they always distinguish between the sciences and the social sciences. They think that science is perfect, but social science is subject to some alteration. I studied social work, and when you're taught a theory in social work, the first thing you learn is where it works and where it doesn't work. There's no absolute theory. You learn immediately what the faults of the theory are. And so when I read the Bhagavad Gita, it was a striking difference because I couldn't find fault with it. I'm not saying I could understand it. Even my spiritual master told me it wasn't my intelligence that was finding no fault. It was just because I'd acquired that sukriti to see it as something special. So, yeah, you can approach that angle. Somebody put in a list of things not to do when preaching. And one of them was to try and be an expert on something you're not an expert on. So if you know enough science to argue on the basis of science, you can argue with them. But if you can question the underlying values without getting caught because you don't know enough, then you can do so and just enjoy the discussion. Just sometimes play with the discussion and sometimes be friendly.
Yeah. She said, right. So she said, I believe that. So that was a point that we agreed on.
Yeah.
If anyone else says it's an illusion, that she's not going to listen. But Einstein says it's an illusion, then she'll listen.
Yeah. No, he apparently practically admitted there was a God towards the end of his life. But it's not well publicized.
Wow.
I think it's him, the one that said that his model of the universe came from an explosion. Isn't that him, Einstein? Or is that someone else? Somebody had a model of the universe in their home or in their laboratory, and somebody came in and said, "Oh wow, what a wonderful model! Who built that?" He said, "It came about by an explosion in the laboratory." And the guy said, "I don't believe you, but you believe the theory that it came from a big bang, that the whole universe came from a big bang. Then why can't this model came from an explosion?" So, in that way, you can question that everything is based on hypothesis. And that's where she puts her faith in that hypothesis, and you put your faith in something sublime. But either way, none of it can be seen.
But I did read something yesterday that Prabhupada said that a good way to say it also is that our senses are very imperfect.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really good point too.
Yeah, and even all the instruments they make to measure things, like microscopes and telescopes, and they're also imperfect. They're also limited. Any other comments or questions? Discussion? Sorry?
They don't believe idol worship.
In idol worship? Who don't believe? Christians. Yes, I came from a Christian family. Yeah, so this came about, if you read like the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, you'll understand how it came about. So what happened is that when Jesus was preaching, he was preaching in a limited way to people who had a limited understanding. So he was preaching according to their level of understanding. So what was happening in the synagogues at that time was similar to what was happening in the temples when Lord Buddha came. In the synagogues, they were doing business in the name of religion. They were selling things in order to offer and like this. In the same way that when Buddha came and preached his message, in the temples they were sacrificing animals and they were doing so many things, making money in the name of religion. So Jesus Christ's message was very simple. He was trying to stop that corruption. So he simply preached. He preached against idol worship. But actually, if you read the Bible about the description of what an idol is, an idol is a graven image. An idol is an image of material things. It is basically saying, it is not saying that an idol is an image of God. It's saying that what the Bible considers an idol is an image of something material that you then worship. So it's not excluding deity worship. If you actually read the Bible and study the Bible, you'll find, I mean, I was brought up in a Protestant religion, which was very much against all types of, any type of religious rituals completely. If you'll find in the Catholic religion, they chant on mala, they use incense, they do so many things. They have a murti of like Mary, and they have Christ on the cross. In the Protestant religions, they've gone against most of that. They have just Christ on the cross. Prabhupada used to always criticize. Now look at them. They're torturing Christ. They say he's their hero, but what are they doing? They're putting him on a cross and they're torturing him. They're not actually treating him as representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They're allowing him to suffer on behalf of their sins. But yeah, you have to understand, if you read teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Srila Prabhupada explains the progression, that you can see this Christian is similar to when Buddha appeared. Buddha appeared in order to get rid of the corruption in the temples. So he preached atheism, and he preached ahimsa. His basic preaching was non-violence. You be gentle, you be peaceful, you sit in the middle, you don't go too far one side or too far the other side. You be non-violent. And then, so that made people atheists, but it stopped some of the corruption. And then Shankaracharya came. So there's a verse in the Puranas where Lord Shiva tells his wife Parvati, I'm going to come in the form of a brahmana and I'm going to bewilder people. So Shankaracharya came and he wanted to bring people back to the Vedas. But there were so much Buddhists, there were so much voidists, that he couldn't preach the full message of the Vedas. So he preached impersonalism. He was basically, according to our acharyas, preaching veiled voidism. He was preaching something similar to Buddhism, but he was bringing it back to the Vedas. Because that's all people in that stage of consciousness could accept. So then after him, then came like Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya. And they started preaching how God is different from people. But still is not the full conception. And then coming on down the line, and then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu come. And he's giving us the highest perfection. So Krishna comes and he sends his representative. But they can only teach according to the capacity of the people they're teaching. So when Jesus Christ came, he was trying to stop corruption. So he preached against idol worship. But if you look in the Bible, you will go through those few verses, you will find that it doesn't exclude deity worship. If you have an open mind, it's excluding worship of something material. And I brought my mother to the temple. I arrived in the country one time, and I told my mother to come to the temple and meet me. And she'd never been in a temple before, so it was too much for her. Like even the first time I went to the temple, my friend brought me to the temple and said, oh, this is, and named the deities. And I had no idea who they were because I didn't know anything about the philosophy. She just brought me to the temple. She said, I'm taking you to the Hindu temple. So on the altar, all on the same level, was Gornitai and Radha Govinda and Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman. And they were all sitting there on a line, and I had no idea who they were. I didn't know it was even God. I had no idea. But like that, my mother came to the temple. And so she came to the Auckland temple, and there was Gornitai, and then Radha Giridhari, and then Jagannath Baladev Subhadra. But on that particular day, they were also having a fire yagya. So that terrified her even more, for a very strict, you know, Protestant. And then not only there were idols on the altar, but there was also some fire sacrifice going on. She never came back again. But anyway, she got the transcendental vision of the deities, even if she had no idea what she was looking at. Yeah, generally, if you want to explain to the Christians who say no idol worship, you can look up that portion in the Bible. You can find it on the internet if you don't have a copy. You can look up the internet. The other thing you'll find is if you're researching to preach to the Christians, is you'll find that there are so many different editions of the Bible and so many different translations. Like when they try and twist this thou shalt not kill into meaning thou shalt not kill humans, not thou shalt not kill animals. You'll find that the original Hebrew actually is talking about violence. It's not actually talking about killing at all when you go back to the original words. And so the translations are interpreted differently, and so many things are there. But yeah, if you have Christian friends and you want to explain to them, you can do some research and you can explain to them nicely without challenging them, because Prabhupada also explained that he accepted Jesus Christ as a bona fide representative preaching the message of God. The features of a true religion, he named two features of a true religion. One is that they have a handed down scripture, not a man-made scripture. And the scripture is handed down from God. And the second is that they are trying to teach love of God. So Christianity has both those features. Prabhupada said there's no problem with that. The problem is they're not following it.
What about the Muslim faith? Is that also?
Yes, that is also considered. Because, and people who know the Quran, even there's a discussion with Lord Chaitanya and the Qazi in Navadvip about the Quran, and how Lord Chaitanya convinced the Qazi that actually the Quran was saying the same thing that he was saying. And people are saying that in the Quran it also says that God is a black color and a dark color or something. And it teaches love of God. I think the Sikhs are not talking about God, are they, and love of God? You studied?
As far as I know.
Okay.
I do so.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know so much about some of the other religions. But if a religion is yeah, there are.
Instead of singing songs, the big Bible and they use.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think their philosophy got twisted a little on the way. So I think they're not bona fide at the moment, the way they teach the philosophy. Hare Krishna.
Mataji, you were just talking about they should not kill, something like that. That's something that actually happened. And talking to Christian people, I read the Bible. And there are in the Ten Commandments, one of them is they should not kill. But then when you talk to people, just in combination with Bhagavad Gita or your religion, then we're talking about not killing, and Jesus said, or not Jesus, Almighty God said they should not kill. But then the answer of Christian nowadays, I want to know what is your opinion. Nowadays Christians say, no. First we were living under the law. When Jesus Christ was born, all the law thing was annihilated. It was finished. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, but this is not a general Christian viewpoint. This is maybe one specific sect. This is not what I grew up with. They did not say that. They
nowadays they say no.
Yeah, but this may be one particular part of Christianity. Like Christianity has Protestants and Christians and New Age, what they call the charismatic religions, and so many different Seventh-day Adventists call them self-Christians. So it's not everybody who believes that. I did not grow up with saying that the law is not doesn't count. We grew up that we studied the New Testament, which is the stories written by the, what they call the apostles. A lot of this, like this Paul and David and whatever else, I forget. I didn't study. I went to classes, but I didn't study very seriously. But yeah, that is taken as reference from the Old Testament. But the Old Testament is still there. It's not being forgotten. It's not being discarded. Maybe by some of the sects of Christianity. Like there are so many different sects. Like Hinduism has so many different sects. But we're not actually claiming to be Hindu. We're claiming to be Sanatan Dharma. So, yeah, we're not trying to criticize so much the religion as to try and see the commonalities. So most people accept the Ten Commandments that I know. That's why there's so much discussion. If you look on the internet, there's so much discussion about how to interpret the Ten Commandments. Somebody said that God gave Ten Commandments and the human beings turned it into 33 million laws, but they still can't follow them. In order to enact Ten Commandments, they made 33 million laws, something like that. So most people accept the Ten Commandments, but they interpret the way they're supposed to follow them. And you'll find people arguing that Jesus Christ was a fisherman, so therefore you should accept fish, and he distributed loaves and fishes, so therefore he distributed fishes. You should eat fishes. But then there'll be if you want to do some research, you'll find people who disagree with that as well, who know the history at that time and know what's happening. So I find it best, if you're preaching to people, try not to find the differences, but try to find the commonalities. Because there's a verse in the Mahabharata somewhere that describes that you can't persuade anybody anything by argument. Defeating someone in argument will not get them to agree with you. You may defeat them. They may even admit defeat, but they won't come over and believe what you want them to believe. You have to win people over by friendship and by finding the common ground, finding what their struggles are and trying to show them a better way of solving their struggles. So like that, I'm not a preacher. I'm speaking from theory. But I know that you can't force anybody to do anything. You can't change people's minds. You have to try and make friends. And in that way, you're engaging them in getting some sukriti. Like Lord Chaitanya took sannyas in order to try and get some of the Mayavadis to treat him with respect. And then if they treat him with respect, then they gain some piety. So in a similar way, if we behave in a saintly way, and people treat us with respect and think nicely of us, then Krishna will say, oh, he's treating my devotee nicely. Let me give him some sukriti. Let me give him some piety. So that's how we're going to help people. We're not going to help people by our argument. We're going to help people by becoming saintly and trying to share what we know. And then the people will be attracted. And they will gain the piety, and one day they will come and ask some questions with a submissive spirit.
And what does Socrates mean?
Sukriti, that means piety. It's a Sanskrit word that means piety. So in our scriptures, piety is described as different kinds. Like you have karma sukriti, jnana sukriti, and you have sukriti for devotional service. So sukriti for devotional service has got a long name called Bhakti Onmukhi Sukriti. But what it means basically is if we serve a devotee, serve a sadhu, then that's a special kind of sukriti. If we just happen to do something good, like giving charity, that might only give us piety that give us to the heavenly planets. It might only give us piety to give us a nice life. But if we do something like listening to the devotee or serving the devotee, even like serving Tulsi, that's why Tulsi is in our worship, then that's a devotional piety that will help ultimately get Krishna to
I'm
give
not
some
a devotee,
this.
Per se, I'm just visiting here for the week.
Yeah.
But I'm amazed by all the knowledge that is here from these classes and things. It's quite
Yeah, it's wonderful. Where do you come?
5 years back, I had so much culture shock.
Okay.
I'd never seen Krishna, and I was like, oh my God, I'd never seen people eating with their hands and things. I had so much culture shock. I was here 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Five years before. So I had a huge healing crisis.
Yeah.
And I came to Vrindavan, didn't even know what Vrindavan was about.
So,
and
yeah.
So much to get on my feet. So God works in mysterious ways, you know. And so I said, oh, I'll come back now 5 years later to
good.
Visit. And I ended up living in India 4 or 5 years. So,
nice.
But this was my beginning. And I had a very advanced devotee 5 years back that helped me through to get settled here, you know. So some of the knowledge that all of you have is quite impressive. I try to read the Bhagavad Gita, and after two or three sentences, I say, it's much more touching to have someone else explain it and read it.
Yeah. Bhagavad Gita, of course, is it's a full philosophy.
I think I've read it so many times, and I'm a huge reader, but for some reason, it's just, I'm not, I get the message so much easier when I'm listening to someone read it, and talk about it.
Yeah, that's the way the system works. There's a verse that says the same, Satam Prasanga Mama Viri Samvado Bhavanti Rid Karanaya Rasayana Kata. So, when the messages of Krishna are heard in the association of devotees, then the message goes from the ear to the heart. Whereas, otherwise, if we try and understand with our intelligence, then we won't get the realization, because intelligence keeps on a mental platform. But this rid karana means from the ear to the heart. So in the association of devotees, it will come to the heart, and it works. How long? Around 15 years.
15?
Yeah, I'm a late starter. But it's never too late. And we're thankful that we've got there.
I just go from some different spiritual teacher, master, samadhi, to another spiritual teacher, samadhi, and that's what I'm doing for the next 6 months. And
good.
I have a bitter and hard life, so. It's okay.
Good. The sincere inquiry will get you success. No problem.
But I might go to Mumbai now, so I really so enjoyed my week here in Vrindavan. I might go to Mumbai and I've heard there's a great temple there.
There's a beautiful temple there in Juhu, nice big temple. And there's another smaller temple in Mira Road near the Bhaktivedanta Hospital.
That's in Mumbai.
Yeah, Juhu is somewhere beachside, and Mira Road is somewhere else. And I'm not an expert on Mumbai. I've been to both. And, very nice. Nice place. Good. Any other discussion? All right, we've made a class today. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai.